Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Next week, the Supreme Court convenes early to consider a case that could define the future of campaign finance law in the United States. At the heart of it all is a scathing 2008 political documentary titled Hillary, the Movie.
We must never underestimate this woman. We must never understate her chances of winning. And we must never forget the fundamental danger that this woman poses to every value that we hold dear.
The FEC called it electioneering, funded by a corporation, and blocked its airing on pay-per-view TV during the 2008 campaign. The film's makers called that a violation of free speech. What the High Court decides could shape the future of elections for a long while. This hour on Point, campaign money, political speech, and the Supreme Court. And you can join the conversation. How do you think the law should balance free speech and fair elections? Should limits on campaign finance be rolled back or strengthened? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me first today from Washington, D.C., is Joan Biskupic. She is the Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today, and her new book coming out in November is American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Joan Biskupic, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jackie.
So tell us more about this case. If people haven't heard about it, the timing of it, the size of it is really exceptional.
Well, as you suggested, Jackie, in your opening, the Supreme Court is certainly at a pivotal moment in the history of government limits on corporate expenditures in elections. The justices themselves teed it up to a more important case last June when they announced that they would use the Hillary movie dispute to decide not just whether Citizens United was engaged in electioneering communications, but whether rulings that have inhibited corporate election spending over the past couple decades should be reversed.
And Citizens United, I'll just remind people, is the conservative not-for-profit that made the film.
Correct, correct. In fact, the clip that you aired really does capture the tone of Hillary, the movie, by this group that's long been critical of the Clintons. And what the group says is that, you know, this is our First Amendment right to have this kind of a movie. It was not intended to be an election message. It's a feature-length documentary is how they cast it. But what happened, Jackie, is that when the FEC, Federal Election Commission, challenged the group's ability to offer it on TV video on demand service, a special three-judge federal court in Washington looked at the film and said, this is no documentary. It's a campaign ad with the message that people should vote against Hillary Clinton. And the lower court upheld the campaign restriction at issue, which I should note arises from the 2002 congressional legislation that's commonly known as McCain-Feingold for its two Senate sponsors, John McCain and Russ Feingold. So that was how the whole case started, you know, developed from this presidential campaign of 2008. But what happened then after the justices heard arguments on that key question about the film was that they recast the case to say, we want to look at past rulings that have allowed states and the federal government to inhibit corporate election spending and to see whether they actually violate the First Amendment guarantee of free speech.
So,
as you know, Jackie, the court has long equated campaign money with political free speech.
Right. So just to point out and recap, it used this movie, which frankly is a screed. I think we might agree on that. Listeners might agree. It is a relentless movie, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Used a fairly narrow ruling to look at something much broader. There are 26 states that restrict corporate finance expenditures, and the number of briefs that have piled on here is huge.
That's right. In fact, when the case was first heard in March, I believe we had only 13 friend of the court briefs come in. Once the justices said, we're going to look at something much broader, three times as many friend of the court briefs came in, just because, as you note, the political stakes suddenly were higher.
And can you tell me something about the timing here, coming back from vacation early to hear this? Does that signify something special?
Yes, it does, because it's incredibly rare, as you suggest, for the justices to hear a case in September. Their regular term runs from the first Monday in October until late June. But when they decided to broaden the question here, they effectively said, we're going to make this part of our last term. It's actually being heard in what is technically the 08-09 term. So they're just going to come back next Wednesday, hear this case, and then they won't hear anything until the first Monday again. But Jackie, I think that's because they probably want to have a ruling come out enough ahead of the 2010 election cycle, because as you know, we've got the midterm elections coming up in 2010, and if suddenly the campaign finance rules are changed, the players on all sides should know that.
Yes, because of course it takes months before there's an actual decision.
Right.
Joan, is there any indication about which way different justices will vote on this? I mean, we've seen more narrow interpretations of campaign finance ruling on the John Roberts Court, but this is also the first case for Sonia Sotomayor.
Right. That's a very good question, and I think that also, Jackie, has contributed to how many briefs have come in the case. This is a court that's plainly in transition on its views of campaign finance regulation. Chief Justice John Roberts, who joined the court in 2005, and Justice Samuel Alito, who joined the court in 2006, have been less inclined to uphold government campaign finance rules than their predecessors. And we saw in rulings just since they came on that they've been more scrutinizing of provisions of the McCain-Feingold law and the general idea that the First Amendment principles maybe should take a back seat to government interest in regulating what could be corruptive speech.
This is also made for some really strange bedfellows. Could you talk about that?
Right.
On both sides.
Yes. In fact, free speech First Amendment cases don't break down as neatly along ideological lines generally. But in this one, we have, you know, the ACLU has long been against various campaign finance regulations. They've sided more with where the First Amendment concerns. And one group that's in with the National Rifle Association, for example, which people usually equate with more conservative causes, is on the same side as, for example, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which many of your listeners would equate with more liberal causes. But they each have their own concerns of what can be aired, what kind of free speech issues will prevail over government regulation. But I do have to say that all of these positions of people who might be either on the Citizens United side or the Federal Election Commission side, they're fairly nuanced. It's not as neat as, yes, we definitely think all these precedent on corporate expenditure limits should be overturned completely, or they should all be upheld. There's some play in the joints there, but it has made for a case that, as you say, has some strange bedfellows.
Well, and not only amongst the interested groups, but also even amongst the legal representation.
Yes. In fact, there will be four lawyers who will argue next Wednesday. And in fact, one thing that's interesting is that Ted Olson, who many of your listeners will remember as a former U.S. Solicitor General under George Bush, who at one time actually defended a version of the McCain-Feingold law, will now be challenging it on behalf of Citizens United. So he's actually switched midstream here, having left the government and now representing Citizens United and their film Hillary the Movie. But you also have Fred Abrams, who will be Floyd Abrams, who will be representing Senator Mitch McConnell, who's long challenged the McCain-Feingold law. The Fred arises from Fred Wertheimer, who is a very strong player in this as a friend of the court, having been part of a friend of the court brief on the part of Democracy 21, which is a government watchdog group, which is on the side of defenders, the Federal Election Commission, and Senators McCain and Feingold, who will be represented by yet another former Solicitor General, Seth Waxman. And just on that score, the now current Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, will actually be arguing her first case on Wednesday, Jackie.
For court watchers, it's a full slate. But it is also just getting huge national attention, which if people miss, probably feels like a tsunami. But one article I read said you could make a cottage industry of how many blog postings, public briefings, even grassroots organizing has gone on around the issue of corporations' role in political campaigns.
That's right. There's just a lot of money at stake when you think of the amount of corporate wealth. And also, I should add, Jackie, this law also applies to labor unions. So the AFL-CIO is in on the side of Citizens United and their Hillary the Movie.
We've only got about a minute. What is the big case that could be overturned by this ruling?
Sure. It's the 1990 case known as Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce. That was a 6-3 decision written by the late Thurgood Marshall that said that a Michigan law that prohibited corporations from using their general treasury funds for expenditures in connection with state elections was valid. The court, as I said, a 6-justice majority, rejected a First Amendment challenge. And the three dissenting justices at the time were Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Anthony Kennedy. And a lot of your listeners probably think of Anthony Kennedy as someone who swings in the middle a lot on cases. But in this particular case, he will be back and firmly trying to probably vindicate that dissent in the 1990 Austin case to make sure that these kinds of restrictions do not hold up in the face of First Amendment concerns.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the big campaign finance case coming before the Supreme Court next Tuesday. At the heart of the case is Hillary the Movie, a 2008 attack documentary that sharply criticized Hillary Clinton. Here, pundits, including Ann Coulter, described their impressions of Mrs. Clinton.
Ruthless, vindictive,
venal, sneaky,
ideological, intolerant.
Liar is a good one.
Scares the hell out of me.
And we're joined this hour by Joan Biskupic, with whom we've been speaking. She's Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today, and her new book coming out in November is American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Also joining us from Arlington, Virginia, is Allison Hayward. She's an assistant professor of law at George Mason University, and she filed an amicus brief supporting the makers of Hillary the Movie on behalf of herself and several other campaign finance scholars. Allison Hayward, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for having me, Jackie.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Tara Malloy. She's associate legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan watchdog organization that works in the area of campaign finance and elections. She was the lead lawyer in drafting the center's amicus brief defending the constitutionality of federal restrictions on corporate campaign spending. And Tara, I think I mispronounced your name, in favor of one of my favorite Irish places, Tara Malloy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I want to ask all of you to chime in here. Allison, might we start with you? You filed a brief, an amicus brief, supporting the makers of Hillary the Movie. Could you tell us why and what your reasoning is, please?
Certainly. Well, I thought that in the debate generally, there was a assumption or a point that required further examination, which is the argument that is made by defenders of the corporate expenditure ban, that this is a long-lived law, that we've had restrictions on corporate political activities since the passage of the Tillman Act in 1907, and for the court to now say that such a law might be unconstitutional would really be very upsetting to long-held precedent. And in my academic work, I look at campaign finance, and I've gotten quite involved in a variety of inquiries into the legal history and legislative history of various campaign finance laws. And the astonishing thing is, for how old these restrictions are, the court hasn't really done the same sort of searching inquiry into their motives, their effects, their history that they would do in other areas of, you know, free speech jurisprudence. The one direct constitutional challenge to the Tillman Act basically sort of waved past the constitutional question altogether. That was in a different time, a long time ago, where our First Amendment law wasn't, you know, the same form it is now. But I've felt that because of my research, I was well positioned to bring to the court some information that they probably weren't going to get from someplace else. And that's really what an amicus brief is for. It's not to re-argue the case on behalf of people who aren't parties. It's to try and bring the court a perspective they otherwise might not see in the context of the case, so that it's, you know, appropriate for the court to consider your information and your research and your arguments.
All right. Tara Molloy, how about your decision? You're the associate legal counsel for the Campaign Legal Center. What's your reasoning?
Yes, well, we also filed an amicus brief, and we wanted to stress that not only are the restrictions on corporate expenditures a very long tenure, as Allison pointed out, they have been in existence on the federal level since 1947, and they have regulated corporations since 1907. But the restrictions on corporate expenditures, the constitutionality of these restrictions have been affirmed time and time again by the Supreme Court, of course, in the 1990s decision in Austin, which is now in question, but also in the 2003 decision in McConnell, as well as at least being acknowledged in the 2007 decision in Wisconsin Right to Life. So these restrictions are something that have been sort of approved time and time again, and in no way are sort of outliers in the campaign finance regime. And so we wanted to file a brief to show how the Austin case, which is now under fire, is very much of a piece with the entirety of the Supreme Court's campaign finance jurisprudence. So you just can't excise it. You would simply sort of unravel the entirety of the jurisprudence. So that was a point that we wanted to make, and that clearly in this type of case where the corporate expenditure restriction has become, in the words of McConnell, firmly embedded in our law, considerations of stare decisis apply very strongly. That is, stare decisis, respect for past precedent, and that here the court really should take caution before taking any radical steps.
Could you just say briefly, both of you, Tara and Allison, what outcome are you hoping for? I mean, obviously, you hope that the court will rule in favor of your position, but if you could be a little bit more nuanced than that.
Well, there's a spectrum of outcomes. And that's one of the things that's sort of exciting about this case.
We're hearing from
whether
Allison
or not
now.
You're mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry. This is Allison. Whether or not you're a partisan on behalf of Citizens United or on the other side, you know, the legal nut at the core of this is all about whether video on demand is broadcasting for purposes of the electioneering communication ban. Well, that's about as technical and about as in the weeds as you get in campaign finance law, and it may be that the court will look at all this new information, look at this re-argument, and say, you know, we can, you know, dismiss this. You know, we can get rid of this case on a relatively narrow ground that most of us can agree on, and so we'll have a opinion that most of the court can join on this very technical issue. Then you've got, you know, the next step of how should we be regulating communications that the listener voluntarily sort of pulls into their home rather than being pushed on them as the conventional advertisement is, because this is something like that. Is there a First Amendment doctrine that would distinguish between that sort of voluntary receipt of message from whatever source, corporate or not, against, you know, the advertisement that's pushed on somebody sort of unexpectedly or unwillingly? And then there's, you know, the broader question of whether or not all sorts of corporations ought to be treated identically under the law as they are right now, where corporate status is the touchstone for whether or not you can make an expenditure. Does Congress need to distinguish between, say, large publicly held corporations like, you know, General Electric and something like Citizens United that's got the corporate form largely for, you know, limiting liability on their directors and so they can, you know, execute their tax-exempt status?
Of course, we don't know exactly where the money is coming from in Citizens United, do we?
We don't know where the money's coming from any time, you know, an individual makes an expenditure, too. Mm-hmm. You know, they might get paid, they might get, you know. So, in fact, there's a transparency question, which you're alluding to, about whether or not people who make these kind of expenditures should also say that they got their money from some other source for that expenditure, or they got such funding in the last year as might, you know, provide, you know, support for that expenditure. That question is also something that's wrapped up in this case. So, you know, there's this spectrum of, you know, going from the very technical to the very, you know, broad, I've got to think that the court is willing to take on the broader questions, or they wouldn't have asked for re-argument. That mm-hmm. seems plain. But how broad? You know, it's – I don't know.
Right.
I'm feeling kind of like – which is, makes it exciting for a law professor like me, but also risky for everybody.
Well, it certainly makes it very worrisome from the campaign finance reform advocacy side of things. And naturally, we want the Supreme Court, ideally, to simply uphold the district court, which found that McCain-Feingold could be constitutionally applied to Hillary the movie to prohibit Citizens United from using its treasury funds to finance a movie. However, it's certainly true, as Allison has pointed out, that there is sort of a range of different arguments being made by Citizens United in this case. And I would stress that the whole issue of overturning Austin, that is, the precedent upholding restrictions on corporate expenditures, only came up first at the Supreme Court level. That is, that Citizens United only pressed this argument once it had arrived at the Supreme Court, and it was not really an issue in the district court below. This is important because usually in a case of this magnitude, you would have the opportunity to create a factual record, you know, showing what type of corruption or what type of problems corporate expenditures might show, might produce. So that is a particular concern of campaign finance advocates, because you have the Supreme Court drastically broadening the case upon re-argument, and then you don't really even have very much of a record or even very much argumentation going to the point of the dangers or perhaps benefits of corporate spending in federal elections. So while, of course, we hope that the Supreme Court simply upholds the district court, we are particularly worried that it might reconsider Austin on such a sparse record. And indeed, the Citizens United has raised other much more narrow arguments that could resolve the case. There's no need to go to Austin. For instance, as others have pointed out, there is a question of whether video on demand is really the same as a broadcast television or cable show. And that's sort of a technical question, which, you know, I would acknowledge was not really probably really considered by the sponsors of BCRA back in 2002. That's sort of a new technological development. And perhaps there should be more attention paid to that, or the FEC should reconsider that on a remand or something to that effect. But again, we hope that the district court's upheld, but certainly the court should rule on narrow issues that have been fully briefed and not on the question of the viability of Austin when there's been so little sort of argumentation on it.
All right,
Jackie.
Well, yes, Joan?
Yes, I thought maybe this would be a good time to point out the larger question about the direction of the Roberts Court and its regard for precedent, because both Tara and Allison are sort of speaking to the larger question of when the justices should reconsider a precedent. If this is a good time to mention sort of the larger pattern of the court. As many people have been reminded in this litigation, when John Roberts was up for confirmation, he talked about when should the court shift gears, when should it go back on precedent, and he used the word jolt, saying that the Supreme Court shouldn't do something that jolts the system, and that word has kind of come back in several of the friend of the court briefs. In fact, Senators McCain and Feingold say overruling the earlier decisions that have been referred to here, the 1990 Austin decision and the 2003 McConnell decision, would, in their minds, severely jolt our political system. And, you know, a big question of the direction of this conservative-dominated Roberts Court is what will its regard for prior precedents be, and I think that's why, you know, some groups have come in to say, look, if you look at the history of your rulings, look at the history of what Congress has been able to do since 1907 and since 1947 in the Taft-Hartley Act, and that this would be quite a shift in precedent. But then the other side, I think, you know, one of the points that Allison was making was to bring to the court's attention that maybe some of these decisions weren't as entrenched as they might be. So that's why there's this whole other issue playing out against the backdrop of a pretty sexy topic of politics and campaign spending. We'll see a lot about the Roberts Court in this decision.
Right. Okay, let's take some listener calls. We've had quite a few people waiting, and Troy is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Troy.
Welcome, Jackie. Thank you. My first comment is if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. The voters know what is fact and fiction. So the movie was entertainment. I live in Iowa where politicians come to become president, and we beat them up. I have asked personally Hillary, do you charge the Secret Service rent for your house? I have asked John Edwards if he would take a drug test. I have asked Bill Richardson if he would sell the Lincoln bedroom for campaign donations. These are things that should be told to the public. And if this movie entertains us, it is a speech, and those words should be spoken, not hidden from the public.
Okay. Thanks for your comment, Troy. Let's get in another call. Margie is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts.
Hi there. One point I haven't heard anything about is the definition of who is claiming this freedom of speech. Our Constitution guarantees freedom of speech to the individual, and yet here the corporation is asking for the freedoms and protections and guarantees of freedom of an individual, yet corporations don't take the responsibility of an individual.
All right.
So I'd like to hear a comment on the definition of who the litigant is in this case.
All right. Thank you.
Jackie, I'd be happy to jump in on that. This is Allison.
Mm-hmm.
I think the concern, something I was trying to draw out a little earlier, is the fact that under the law right now, corporations are treated identically, regardless of whether they're ideologically motivated corporations, regardless of whether they're big business corporations, regardless of whether they're multinationals. And, you know, the Constitution correctly applies First Amendment liberties to individuals. But one of those First Amendment liberties is the freedom of association. And so the question becomes, so you get together with a group of people. In our day and age, groups tend to need to incorporate for a variety of reasons, not the least because it makes it easier to deal with the IRS. By simply taking that corporate classification, without more, does a group turn into a prohibited source? And I think that's a question that, you know, Congress has never really addressed, because at the time they, you know, first passed corporate, you know, political restrictions, the character of a corporation in the United States was very different. It wasn't everybody, you know, every little group practically engaging in incorporation. Corporate charters were still relatively difficult to get. And so you had, you know, large trusts being thought of as the, you know, sine qua non of the corporate, you know, body. And that's just not the case anymore. You know, your local, pretty much any group that wants to get together is going to have this corporate status. Can we distinguish between, you know, non-business motivated corporate entities as opposed to business-oriented corporate entities? And, you know, that's been something that the law has struggled with for a long time. It was something that the progressives struggled with in the wake of the Tillman Act. It was something that was brought up again as a concern about the reach of the legislation through the 40s and the 50s. It's a perennial problem. It hasn't gone away. It would be really nice if the Supreme Court addressed it in this case.
Well, I think our listeners will have a lot of questions about what is a corporation and what is it allowed to do in the matter of political speech when we come back in our next segment. Joan, we'd really like to thank you for being with us. Joan Biskupic, she joined us from Washington, D.C., Supreme Court correspondent for USA Today. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, the big campaign finance case coming before the Supreme Court next Tuesday. The case concerns Hillary the Movie, a scathing political documentary about Hillary Clinton, which was originally scheduled to be offered on pay-per-view the night before the 2008 Democratic primary in January, but was blocked by the Federal Election Commission.
Who is Hillary Clinton?
She's continually trying to redefine herself and figure out who she is.
At least with Bill Clinton, he was just, you know, good time Charlie. Hillary's got an agenda.
Hillary is really the closest thing we have in America to a European socialist.
If you thought you knew everything about Hillary Clinton, wait till you see the movie. Hillary, the movie, on DVD now.
And we're joined by Allison Hayward, assistant professor of law at George Mason University and author of an amicus brief supporting the makers of Hillary, the movie, and by Tara Malloy, associate legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center and the lead lawyer in drafting the center's amicus brief defending the constitutionality of federal restrictions on corporate campaign spending. And Tara, Allison was speaking just before the break about some of the history behind this. Let me ask a little bit about where we are now in terms of campaign finance reform. There has been a lot of movement insisting upon this in just the last 6, 7, 8 years as more and more money is spent on political campaigns, hasn't there?
Yes. I mean, I think that campaign finance has become an even greater concern as the money spent in elections, not just by corporations, but also by candidates and political parties, keep breaking their old records. They sort of keep spiraling upward and upward. And corporations certainly play a big role. And I think I'd like to respond to the question as to what corporations exactly are covered by the law right now, because Allison mentions that Citizens United is a nonprofit corporation, and that's certainly true. But overruling the Alston decision will undercut the rationales, not just for restrictions on nonprofit corporations, but also for restrictions on for-profit corporations. And as you pointed out, there is a fear of the huge treasury funds of for-profit corporations overwhelming the electoral system. As just a point of comparison, the annual profits of all American corporations in 2005, I believe, were about $1 trillion, according to the IRS. However, President Obama, in his historic record-breaking fundraising race, raised $745 million or thereabouts. And so it's easy to see how overwhelming, again, corporate expenditures could be. And there are ways that the court has already protected nonprofit corporations from the laws mm-hmm. that really were sort of designed to insulate the system from huge for-profit corporate spending. And in fact, it's important to note that there already is an exemption for sort of true nonprofits if a nonprofit is an advocacy group and if it does not have shareholders. And most importantly, if it does not accept business corporate funds, it is already exempted from the law. And that is an exemption that very often gets forgotten in the sort of florid debates about bans and free speech, that a sort of true nonprofit is exempted. And in fact, Citizens United accepted a small amount, 5%, of business corporate funds to produce Hillary the movie. And had it not, you know, we would all not be here today. They would be eligible for the exemption. And, you know, we would not have this groundbreaking Supreme Court case. So that is another point that I did want to stress.
And then they would have just gone ahead and put it on pay-per-view TV, I guess.
Exactly.
Sherry is calling from Lynnville, Tennessee. Sherry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Welcome.
Well, I think most people feel that our whole governmental process, both electoral and lawmaking, has been hijacked by for-profit corporations. And I'm wondering what it would take to forbid profit-making corporations from lobbying Congress and contributing to campaigns, period. You know, the government's supposed to be by the people and for the people, not for the corporations.
Okay, thanks for that point and question, Sherry. Both of you, we certainly have had that worry in American life, political life. Fred Wertheimer, longtime activist with Common Cause and other groups, said, we're not dealing with campaign finance laws. We're dealing with the essence of power in America. What about that concern? Allison?
Well, I guess, you know, there are a number of states that don't prohibit corporate expenditures and contributions like the federal government does. And I'm not really aware that corporations have drowned out politics in those jurisdictions. I mean, I'm not sure how you compare, say, California as against Virginia. They're just vastly different places. And it doesn't seem like there's anything about corporate activity that has ruined one and not the other necessarily, you know, because there are just so many other things that are going on.
Uh-huh.
You know,
just out of curiosity, which of those states prohibits these kinds of contributions? You mentioned California.
Well, both of those states permit it.
Mm-hmm.
Both California and Virginia allow corporate political activity that we're talking about. And they're just vastly different places with vastly different problems. And there's nothing about the corporate activity that's made the place any, you know, different than it would have been, I guess is what I'm saying in sort of an inarticulate way. The interesting comparison between campaign finance regulation and lobbying regulation is one that the caller brought up that I think is worth noting because we don't see restrictions on lobbying like we do on campaign spending. Why is that? The simple-minded answer is that lobbying is, you know, petitioning your government for redress of grievances, and that's protected under the First Amendment. But that's a circular argument if you're comparing it with campaign finance law, because campaign activity is protected under the First Amendment too. The question is, how broad is that protection? Lobbying, you know, focuses on incumbents, legislation, and people in power. Campaign finance laws affect, you know, incumbents and challengers equally. In a sense, are kind of broader and maybe in some way less fair. I understand that the caller's troubled by corporate influence. I have a hard time in general imagining in a capitalist society that you don't have corporate influence on policy. And I think, you know, the genius of the founders was they tried to balance factions against factions by creating sort of a divided federal government. Because you aren't going to change the character of profit-making enterprises unless you really fundamentally change the economy. And I don't think we're going to go that far.
Let's take another call. Robin is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Welcome to On Point, Robin.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Very interesting topic here. It's a hard one to zoom in on the crux of it, but I think it is this economic issue that, yeah, in a capitalist society, you know, the way things have evolved politically, you know, corporations are defined legally as being equivalent to individuals. And obviously for commercial reasons, they need free speech, at a minimum for commercial business reasons. But when you get into the political arena, it's obvious that, you know, they're like the 500-pound gorilla in the room compared to real individuals, and that they have these massive interests and these massive resources. You know, I mean, they dominate political life in America, whether most people realize it or not already. You know, I don't think campaign reform, finance reform is going to solve this problem. I think it's an unsolvable problem. That's why people keep going around with two legitimate viewpoints. The free speech viewpoint is legitimate, and the limit corporate influence viewpoint is legitimate. So, you know, I think it's an illusion to think it's going to be solved by campaign reform. I think the unions need to have equal clout. They need to organize their own political party, a workers' party in this country, I think is the only thing that's going to equalize things, that outspokenly and clearly speaks for workers' interests, which Democrats do not.
Are you a member of a union? You're calling from Detroit.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm a UAW member.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Chrysler guy, but I mean, I've worked a whole lot of different jobs and I've watched the way things go in this country, and I think, you know, I think politics in this country is sort of a shell game where, for lack of a better word, it's the equivalent of professional wrestling or something. I mean, stuff like that movie Hillary, I think, is just it's not entertainment. It is political speech, unquestionably. I don't think it should be restricted. But in terms of the way things are unbalanced and the desire of people to somehow achieve some balance, I'm on that side.
All right. Thank you, Robin. And I think the UAW, there's 59 briefs here. I think the UAW filed one of the briefs in support of the Citizens United group. Let's take another call. Carolyn is calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Carolyn.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for doing this show. I'm a co-chair of an organization that is one of five groups that has an amicus brief that was filed by an attorney named Jeffrey Clements from Concord, Mass. And the two most prominent national groups in this five group our POCLAD program on corporations, law, and democracy, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. The thrust of this brief is that there is a key issue that should be debated as part of this, which is the concept of corporate personhood. And a lot of folks feel that's sort of the elephant in the room. The for over 100 years, the court, it's thought that by these groups and documented that the courts have been preferencing corporations in law, where federal law then trumps state and local law about protecting local communities against multinational and national corporations. And they've been increasingly using, starting with the 14th Amendment, using the Bill of Rights and growing a body of law that, that says essentially that, that these corporations are entitled to rights that natural persons have in the law.
So let me see if I can break that down just a little more quickly. You're saying that free speech shouldn't be given to corporations because they aren't individuals. They're fundamentally a different entity.
That free speech is meant for people.
Mm-hmm.
That corporations are artificial entities that are created to have a different kind of mission. And, you know, what First Amendment freedoms does to by giving them to a corporation is giving them immunity to lie in the interests of their pursuit.
So you'll be watching this very closely since your group has already filed an amicus brief. Well, thank you very much for that comment, Carolyn. And let's take another listener. Kat is calling from Hawesville, Kentucky. Hello, Kat, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Jackie.
So what's your comment?
Well, I just recently heard an interview with Ted Kennedy, an old one, that he suggested that we publicly finance elections, and I think it sounded like a good idea because that cuts out all these interest groups controlling our elections, gives everybody a voice. I'm really tired of having our politics hijacked by people on both sides using hyperbole, and I'd like to cut out the lies and the things and that tend to go into our politics now. It seems like anybody can say anything that they want to. And to be honest, I disagree with one of the first callers that said that American people know the difference, because I talk to people all the time who don't seem to know the difference between fact and lies.
All right. Thank you very much, Kat. What about these sentiments, both of you, and quickly we're beginning to run out of time, Tara and Allison. The idea, it seems to be put forth and was, I think, on a Huffington Post website, that there could be a president courtesy of Chevron, that nobody, you mentioned money, that nobody has the money to play on the same playing field as a corporation. Quickly, Tara?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that it's not, sadly, an entirely unrealistic fear given the new direction of this court. And, I mean, I think it might be worth going back to the interests that the Supreme Court have articulated as supporting the restrictions on corporate expenditure, since they seem to be a little lost in the debate about what the Roberts Court exactly will do. And that is that, first, the laws are designed to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption in office holders and candidates. As many of the listeners have alluded to, you know, the idea of Shell or Sprint making a $40 million expenditure in, say, let's say, a congressional race where only $3 million is spent clearly raises the possibility that the winner who has benefited perhaps from this expenditure will be indebted to the corporation, that they will even perhaps do their bidding. And certainly it raises the appearance that of corruption that will corrode public confidence in government. And indeed, in the McConnell v. FEC case, which upheld the McCain-Feingold law, the district court found that exactly this effect happens because of corporate ads. Judge Carlo Cotelli of the district court said that candidates and parties appreciate the ads. They're aware of ads by corporations. They may even encourage ads. And that these types of even sort of nominally independent corporate expenditures certainly raise the specter of corruption and the appearance of corruption. So I think that that is a real concern. Mm-hmm. And another interest that the court has recognized is that sort of alluded to by the comments about how corporations are different from individuals. And they certainly are. They have a lot of legal benefits. They have perpetual life. They have limited liability. They can raise huge amounts of funds. And they have advantages, which they leverage to accumulate business income. And the court has always said that the corporations could be restricted from using these treasury funds derived from business income to influence elections because it did not represent public support for the political stances of the corporation. I give money to Dunkin' Donuts for their donuts, or I invest in them because I want to make money. I don't do these actions because I want to support Dunkin' Donuts' corporate expenditures. So that corporate restrictions in campaign finance law are meant to protect the shareholders from having their funds misused, and also just to make sure that corporations don't unfairly leverage their business funds for political purposes.
Okay, thank you. I think we could have gone into the next hour. I want to thank both of you, Allison Hayward and Tara Molloy. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having
me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and you're listening to On Point.